do something that is different. And you look at all the heroes, and that's what they do.
The commitment to listen with the same passion with which we want to be heard.
In terms of who do you want to be, articulate that. Find the words behind that. Who do you want to be?
Hello, and welcome back to the DNA of Purpose podcast, the place where we empower you to build trust, champion adaptability, and cultivate the courage to unleash your unique DNA of purpose. For those of you immersed in purpose-driven business over the past decade, the circular economy isn't a new concept. If you're a leader just encountering it, consider yourself lucky. You are on the brink of discovering an economic paradigm poised to revolutionize business as usual, all with a singular focus: guaranteeing a planet that thrives in health and abundance for generations to come. Now, in offering a glimpse into the circular economy's potential, envision a future where waste is minimized, sustainability is paramount, and resources are efficiently used in a closed loop system. Now, this shift from the traditional use and discard pattern to continuous use and reuse not only champions environmental responsibility, but also brings a wealth of opportunity. The ultimate goal is to elevate our quality of life while safeguarding the future. Now, as a leader navigating this shift towards circularity, it's understandable if you find yourself grappling with the challenge of quite literally dismantling years of entrenched thinking. But if you are a purpose-driven leader, it is crucial to recognize that through circular thinking and action-taking, you quite literally have the power to reshape the future today. As economist Kate Raworth aptly puts it, today we have economies that need to grow whether or not they make us thrive. What we need are economies that make us thrive whether or not they grow. The real question is this: how do we set these social circles in motion? The good news is that today's guest has devoted her life to equipping us with the toolkit. In my view, she is nothing short of world-class in decoding the path forward for purpose-driven pioneers striving to own their part in the creation of a more sustainable world. Her name is Dr. Leila Ajaralu, and she challenges people to think differently about how the world works. As an award-winning designer, sustainability provocateur, social scientist, and entrepreneur, Leila developed the disruptive design method and creates educational experiences, toolkits, and social enterprises that help design a sustainable, circular, and regenerative future. She is a main stage TED speaker, LinkedIn changemaker, and was named UNEP Champion of the Earth in 2016 for her work in advancing science and innovation for sustainability. She is also the founder of the Unschool, Disrupt Design, the CO Project Farm, and Swivel Skills, an enterprise level sustainability skills development platform. In addition to her entrepreneurial initiatives, Leila is the chief circular designer for Circular Australia. And so, as you can see, we are in the hands of a master. So let's get ready to move in circles. Welcome to another episode of the DNA of Purpose podcast. Welcome to the DNA of Purpose podcast. It is such a joy to have you beaming into the studio, Dr. Leila Ajaralu.
Hi.
I hope I got the pronunciation right.
You did.
I nailed
well,
it the first time. I'm like, did I get it the second time? I am not sure.
You did, yeah.
Awesome. Leila, as I was saying prior to hitting record, I have so many questions to ask you today. But I'm actually going to kick off with a question with inner question. Now, I get to, speak to a lot of incredible minds on the podcast, just like yourself. And I'm always curious to understand what questions are these people asking themselves? And so what I'd love to know as a starting point is what question is currently guiding your life or guiding your work forward at this exact moment in time?
That's a good question. I would say, well, there's a few things. Professionally, I'm always very curious about transformation and how that unfolds. I get to work with lots of different stakeholders, whether it be CEOs of major companies through to governments. And in my experience, I get a lot of insights and nuances into what change and transformation is like at different stages. So I'm always questioning that. And actually, that kind of bleeds over into my own personal life. I think if you work in change, you can't help but constantly be questioning how change affects you and when you are willing to change and when you're more resistant to it, right? And I think that that's certainly something in my personal life that's guiding me at the moment is questioning, like, what are the things that are serving me, that are helping me be more efficient, effective, centered, grounded as a person that then supports me in being a more effective change maker. So it's kind of like a bit meta and a bit interconnected. So my experiences of encountering other people's resistance to change kind of helps me focus or reflect back on my own. And so that helps me question and perhaps then explore and experiment with different ways of living and different activities that will help me be a more centered and grounded person in my work.
Oh, I love that. And what a perfect question for someone who, in having spent much of yesterday morning immersed in your work, is not only a provocateur of change, particularly in the sustainability space, but somebody who, in my view, decodes the road forward for people in such an elegant way. I was blown away by
elegant
your work.
Elegant is not a word that I usually get described as, but I'll take it. I will take elegant.
I will give it to you because, you know, when we're talking about what is essentially a paradigm shift in terms of the circular economy, it can feel incredibly overwhelming for people. And having sat through your LinkedIn e-learning course yesterday, which I have to say I didn't mean to do that, but I went right down the rabbit hole, I think you really gracefully break down complexity and make it digestible for everyday humans such as myself.
And I hope that you also laughed a lot at that one because I really amped up the props as much as I could.
I loved the props and they absolutely worked. I have seared into my mind at the moment the difference between the weight of the natural world versus versus the man-made world, which was a kettle, I believe, or something like that. Anyway, moving on, because we do have a lot to get through to kind of capture some of this gold. There's so much to talk about today, but I really want to get inside who you are and understand a little more about your personal story. Looking at your background as an award-winning designer, sustainability provocateur, and social scientist, I'm curious to know, was the desire to, you know, quote unquote, disrupt the status quo and to become an advocate for the planet always an inherent part of who you were as a child growing up? Or was there like a defining moment or point in time where your purpose and your work today became crystal clear?
Yeah, absolutely. There was like a very clear moment where the trajectory of my life absolutely careered off into this space. I think as a kid, I was definitely very into animals and welfare and human rights. And I was, you know, volunteering as a young person with Amnesty's Refugee Committee in Australia when we had all of the first round of crises in that space. So I think I've always been a very passionate person about like what I think is right. And I've been vegetarian my whole life and all this kind of stuff. But as far as like learning about the planet and my role within it, I learned nothing as a child. Like, not my schooling, nor my family, nor anyone else told me that I am a biological being interconnected with all of the natural systems around me and that it is in the imperative of my existence that I support the sustenance of the systems around me so that I can thrive, but also so that we can, you know, live live in a beautiful future, right? Like none of that was ever told to me in any way, shape or form. And I was in my, I think I was in my second year of design studies, and one of our delightful, quite old professors, who was an engineer, kind of did this, like got open literally a textbook that was really fat and just kind of said, you know, opens page 56, we're going to learn about this thing called the Gaia theory, which is that everything in nature is interconnected. You're going to make decisions. They're going to have far reaching impacts on the planet, you know, some bad, some good. So you probably should learn about it. Anyway, like closes the book, pushes it aside, moves on. And I'm sitting there, my brain has just gone, like it just exploded. I was like, oh my gosh, everything just said makes so much sense. Why the hell did I not know this? And so I kind of turned to the rest of the class, which was like predominantly boys at that, and it's quite common in industrial design. And I remember saying, like, I have this etched into my head. Oh my gosh, guys, what are we going to do about this? And like probably a lot of profanity as well. And then this dude sitting next to me was like, I don't know why you're freaking out, Layla. It's not like any of these catastrophic environmental impacts will affect us in our lifetime. So why should we care? And that statement, why should we care, was so profound because I suddenly had this like caring, like massive opening of like a fusion of reality. And here's other people just completely not responding to that. And that juxtaposition, I think, was the thing that seared into my mind as a massive problem and opportunity that we need to figure out how to work through. And so like after that class, I like traipsed myself off to the library and went looking for any books I could on like this new topic that I just uncovered, like nature and the world around me. And, you know, it was definitely the days where books were the primary source of incoming information. And yeah, I found a couple. One was Viktor Papanik, who's like the kind of one of the forefathers of sustainability and design. And also I'm pretty sure it was the Canadian author, I forgot his name right now. Well, another book, I think it was Natural Capital. I can't remember exactly, but I certainly remember crying in the next class when I read this page all about the relationship between the bears, the salmon, and the forest, and like, which is an indigenous, Canadian indigenous knowledge system about the relationship and the interconnected relationship between these elements of the system. And I remember sitting there and looking out the window and looking at like the trees and reading this book and being like, oh my God, everything's interconnected. Truly having like an existential crisis about what I didn't know. And now what I am knowing, and the rightness of these words and these ideas, like it sunk into my being like so quickly. And I was like, oh, this just really makes a lot of sense. But then I had this huge problem because I'm now learning how to basically form plastic and products and make, you know, people buy stuff. And I've suddenly got this like huge awakening and awareness about the potential impacts of those decisions. And I felt very ill-equipped to make those decisions based on what I was learning. So it kind of really did start a bit of an existential crisis. I ended up quitting design school and then found my way through to social science, majoring in sustainability, which I'm so grateful for because my brain and social science were like match made in heaven. Mm. And I didn't realize that I was really smart. Truly. Because I hadn't done very well at school.
Yeah.
And then when I went to study social science, I like ducked my university because everything to me was just like, and I got it all. And it was all so exciting and interesting. And I just, the learning process suddenly became this joyous experience. And then I went on to do my PhD combining social science and design. I did it in industrial design and I actually did it in how to make change through design. And so I kind of had a bit of a full circle experience with my career in that sense.
Oh, there's so many beautiful golden threads in what you just shared. Like, of course, it makes sense that you did social science and sustainability when you look at this focus on interconnectivity. And, you know, what you just said, when you learnt that completely blew your mind. And I'm going down that rabbit hole at the moment with Right Story, Wrong Story, which is a book by Dr. Tyson Yunkaporta. So I'm like right there with you. I'm like, oh, my God, I never knew that. And it's completely flipping my mind.
In Australia as well, we have such a tragic knowledge gap where we have not, as white Australians, been exposed to the incredible knowledge, wisdom, and rightness of Indigenous worldviews and First Nations knowledge systems. And it's something that obviously we have a lot of work to do to rectify, and Tyson is really doing an incredible job in that space. But globally, we have such a loss of potential solutions, but also the wisdom that non-Eurocentric worldviews offer. And that is all over the world where we haven't had colonization, but also where there was colonization and the communities were intentionally repressed and their knowledge was essentially, you know, eradicated, but has still managed to, what's the word, like thrive in certain pockets. And so for me personally, that's like a current learning journey I'm going on. Everything that I now know in sustainability and systems and circularity, I believe, is embedded in First Nations knowledge principles. But too much of the Western world with our academic systems only prioritizes those that get put their name on papers in a journal or get published, which is very hard for a lot of people. So we've essentially, what's the word, like weeded out a lot of knowledge and wisdom that would be so profoundly useful in this moment in time in addressing climate change and addressing biodiversity loss and addressing social equality and the fusions that we have within ourselves in relation to nature. And it's just, it's such a wealth and it's such a tragedy that we still really prioritize only Western worldview. And there's a big movement right now in the design world called decolonizing design, which is really about taking the accountability to question the colonized ideologies that have perpetuated the current kind of fields that we work within. And that requires a lot of presence and patience and openness and leaning into the discomfort of not knowing and questioning some of the things you do know. And I think Tyson's work has really helped to, Tyson and a number of other authors have helped to push us to think differently and respect and acknowledge that perhaps the wisdom that we need to solve the problems are actually not too distant from us.
Fascinating. So I want to paint the picture in relation to the climate crisis. I recently read a quote by a person called Dan Sullivan that says, all progress starts with the truth. And so what I'm wondering is, what is the truth that we need to collectively confront? And from a behavioural change perspective, what is the best way to work with that truth in order to ignite human progress, ecological restoration, to ensure ecological restoration, and environmental stewardship?
So your question is about the human side of that?
Well, it's a twofold question. It's like, what is the state of play? What is the problem? Like, what is the truth? And once we are able to recognize that, you know, we know that people don't necessarily respond to fear. So how do we actually go about leaning in and enabling the change that we need to see in the world to deal with this problem?
Truth. So I can speak to what I know. And what I know is that over the last 75 years specifically, so post-Second World War, we have systematically eroded the natural world through consumerism, and we have created an economy that is inherently addicted to exploitation, extraction, and disposability. And those systems are essentially eroding the entire system of sustaining the only known life-sustaining planet on the universe, which is ours, planet Earth, and that we are, as humans, directly responsible for that. Of course, the decisions made of the past are not the literal accountability of those that exist today, but for sure we are responsible for learning from the past to make better pathways to the future. And so the current state of affairs when it comes to the natural world is that we have exploited the natural ecosystems, whether it be through extracting minerals, petrochemicals, or nature-based materials from, you know, the ocean or from the land. And we've done that at such an extent that we have created an imbalance, a significant imbalance, because nature is always about homeostasis, like our body. It's trying to always find a sense of balance. And over time, it does that by adapting to the changing system. So when we've had ice ages or now we're going into a climate fuel phase, nature will adapt. But the human form is very difficult and very resistant, I should say, to adapting to change. And so what happens is we, as a product of our social experience and perhaps our neuroscience, we're very we consistently want to maintain the status quo, and we like to stay in a comfort zone, like what we're used to. And so ultimately, as the world changes around us, as it is, as we know it is, and especially in regards to the obvious effects of climate change, which I think is hilariously ironic that for the last 25 years, every climate scientist has been like, here's the predictions. And we're now living in the predictions. And people are like, you really?
Whoa. Yeah.
Like all the scientists are like, God.
The scientists were right. Oh my God.
Most of the time, the scientists are right. Anyway. So yeah, ultimately, this kind of disconnect that we have, like in the modern human, right, this kind of Eurocentric or Western world human, very disconnected from the natural world. And that disconnection makes it very easy for us to ignore the impacts of our actions and to rely on nature in a really unequal way. So most people listening to this podcast, I would say, have not grown their own food. They don't know how complex it is and the inputs, the outputs, the time that it takes to grow one broccoli, for example. Mm. We go to a supermarket, we hand over money that we earned trading our skills on a marketplace, and we expect those products to be available and healthy and consistently there. And we don't question the impacts of the choices we make, whether we're buying a steak or a piece of broccoli. And if that then gets, you know, goes rotten in your fridge and you throw it out and then have to go buy something new, we don't have any kind of real understanding of the relationship between those impacts. And that then makes it very easy for us as the modern human to go about our lives causing unintended consequences. And so one of the big goals of sustainability is to actually provide the knowledge and insights about the cause and effect relationships of actions, both individually and collectively, whether that be businesses or governments or even just particular communities, so that we can then make choices around how we grow food, around how we live our lives, around how we design products and services that then ultimately change the course of the future through the choices that we make today. And so the state of play with regards to nature is it is stressed. We have placed an insurmountable amount, insurmountable amount, which sounds like a oxymoron.
It works.
Of pressure on the natural world in both our extraction and our input, so air pollution, toxicity, and also waste. And so in that system, that linear system of extraction, making, and then waste, we have ultimately eroded the life support systems in multiple ways. And that's what's evident through this really interesting scientific work out of the Stockholm Resilience Center called the Planetary Boundaries, which I highly recommend your listeners Google, and you'll see that we've exceeded several of the 9 planetary boundaries. And then there's some work out of Oxford University by economist Kate Raworth, who has taken that concept and created something called the donut economic model, which is the idea that we can not fall off the edge of the outside of the donut, creating an unsustainable future. And we're not going to fall into the middle where it's so constrained that a lot of people don't get their needs met. And so we can find a way of creating a healthy, thriving economy that works within the known parameters of this one life-sustaining earth that we all share. So there's a lot going on and there's a lot of space for people to learn and engage. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I would say is that I think historically sustainability or anything to do with the environment has been seen as being an opt-in, hippie, nice to have sideline. But right now, globally, the transition to a circular and sustainable and even regenerative economy is being embedded in governments. It is no longer something that one kind of person within a massive company will do at lunchtime. It's actually becoming one of the fastest growing requirements in the skill set. There's a really interesting piece of work that comes out every year from LinkedIn called the Green Skills Gap, which looks at the difference between people's stated skills on their LinkedIn profiles and the required job skills in relation to sustainability. And we have a huge gap there. So we don't have universities teaching people how to do this adequately, and individuals within their workplace, most people you speak to know that there's a climate crisis and are probably pretty anxious about it. And yet they go to do their jobs and they're given no space to consider what it is in their job that could actually be done to help address the climate crisis or any of the other environmental and social issues. So that's actually one of the big things that I've been working on recently, is creating tools that support that transition within the workplace. We have an online training platform called Swivel Skills, and that's something that I'm very deeply passionate about, because I don't want people to quit their jobs if they're woken up to this and then go and work for like a not-for-profit in sustainability, because I need people in their jobs changing their skills so that they can help change those companies, because that is really the only way we're going to address sustainability, is when corporations and companies change their practices.
And I mean, your work is incredible in the sense that I've been in the space of purpose-driven business for probably about 7 or 8 years now. And you know, even maybe only 5 years ago, it's, you know, the circular economy and donut economics seemed like a great idea, but, you know, to the naysayers out there, maybe also seemed a little bit far-fetched in the context of our, you know, capitalist world. But today, it really feels like there is genuine momentum building and that this new paradigm is now becoming a possible reality. For our listeners out there who might be unfamiliar with donut economics or the circular economy, could you explain the difference between capitalism and this new economic model that is really crucial in the battle against climate?
Okay, I'll start with the circular economy. So essentially, this is a subset of sustainability. Sustainability is about social, economic, and environmental impacts. It's about understanding the outcome of our actions, both good and bad, and then rectifying or making choices to minimize and hopefully transform those impacts so that we are actually working within the means of the planet, and we're doing that in a socially equitable way, in an economically viable way. And so there's multiple subsets within that, or like under the big umbrella. And the circular economy is definitely a huge part of that. And that is essentially a way of reorientating our current economic model, which is based on, as we said, extraction and exploitation, which is called the linear system, where we take, make, waste. So we take from nature, we make goods and services, and then we waste them. That linear model is inherently unsustainable. And so the circular economy is about closing the loop on that and transforming the way we do business and design products and services so that we have human needs met, but in these sustainable and regenerative ways. And there are three key principles that are commonly shared around the circular economy. The first is to eliminate waste. So we design systems that make waste obsolete. As it stands right now, most products are designed to be wasted. And so we have to redesign our business models so that companies kind of own the product across its whole life, and perhaps they lease you the service, or they have a different relationship with you and the product. Certainly, so for example, we would eliminate single-use products through different systems of reusability that are very frictionless and convenient for people to use. When you're getting your coffee cup, it can be a checkout reusable one, that then you have these receptacles instead of trash cans that you put in. All these kinds of systems-based solutions. So that's the first, eliminate waste. The next one is to make things last longer. So every time we throw something out, we have to go to nature to replace that. And so we're extracting natural resources at a rate that is unsustainable. And so when you make things last longer by repairing them, remanufacturing, encouraging sharing and leasing systems, then we're eliminating that pressure on nature, but we're also then making sure that the goods that exist are basically being utilized to their maximum utility or capacity. And then that does require us to redesign products so that they are repairable and so that they are actually durable. And then the last one is to restore and regenerate nature, which is essentially very important because we always go to nature to take resources. Everything that exists has come from nature and will return. And so we want to then create practices of restoration and regeneration. So a mine site, once we've extracted the resources, the plan of designing that site and that extraction process to have the lowest footprint, but then also have the maximum restoration, for example. And then also by default of doing the first two, we naturally allow for nature to be, I would even say like, not disrupted, because even right now, as we're racing to solve the climate crisis, there's this huge issue of what's called green colonization, where in the race to create batteries and electrification, the resources required to do that are often in pristine indigenous lands. And so we've got a lot of companies going to exploit these resources in very unsustainable ways under the guise of solving the climate crisis. So, you know, part of the problem is we're using the same thinking, the same ideology and mindset to solve the problems caused by that thinking. And that's really one of the big disruptions that we need right now, is we need to transform the way we understand the problem so that the solutions we put in place do not become future problems. And that's really where things like systems thinking come in, that help us understand the nuances and relationships and the social conditions that feed into the problems to begin with. Mm. So I think the key thing here is the circular economy is about changing the way we do business. So it's not just about how we design products and services. It's actually about how we organize society and how businesses meet people's needs and gain economic value through that. And the cool thing is it's not just some pie in the sky idea, like you said, it's literally in laws all over the world. So Australia has actually committed to a circular economy, and I've been working to help advance that with the federal government. We also have the European Union have very robust circular economy and sustainability rules that will affect not just companies that work and exist within the EU, it'll actually affect companies that sell any goods or services into the European Union. You have parts of Asia with circular economy policies. So we're seeing this transformation unfold where the reality of our resource constraints and the significant environmental and social impacts of waste generation and the fact that countries are running out of landfill space, right? Like there's just some really hard realities that are forcing governments to actually take action. But also consumers are demanding more sustainable products. And there's even a huge movement called Zero Waste, which has been growing for the last decade. If you go on Instagram, you'll see so many people who are living particular lifestyles that are really about eliminating waste. And so most major cities now will have shops where you can go and you can bulk buy using your own containers. Like this is a reality that's unfolding. And so companies are responding to those needs as well as the regulatory pressures. So there's a lot going on. It's extremely exciting. I think we're at the forefront of a massive transformation in the way we organize society. And so I encourage your listeners to think about how you can be a part of this. It's not rocket science. You do require some technical skills, but all of that can be, if you've already got a bunch of skills, it's not going to be hard for you to learn the basics and then apply it to what you already know so that you can contribute. And on a personal level, every action that we take in the economy has impacts, right? So we can help make this transformation move faster by choosing to buy different goods and services, because that is then the data that companies use to determine what they'll then create in the future. And so that's all the circular economy. And then as far as donut economics goes, well, I mean, I'm not Kate. Kate explains it best. Her idea is fantastic. Because
it's a good book. Yeah.
And also she's a lot of stuff online and you know, Melbourne and Sydney, if you're listening in Australia, both have donut economic models that are being developed and that you can go online and you can see essentially the cities map their impact across those 9 planetary boundaries that I mentioned, and then start to develop strategies for how we can live within this safe operating space within the donut, basically. So it's a really cool concept. And I think from the city level, it's a really important idea. I would say the circular economy operates more at the business and design of products and services level and requires governments to put in policies that support those kinds of collaborative changes, because actually the circular economy is really about collaboration. You can't have one company just doing it in isolation, because often it's the outputs of one company that become the inputs for another. And we need, so for example, if you're a food services industry company, then you need other companies to do things like the collection and washing of the reusable containers so that you can then provide that service. And this is happening. Like I have a lot of examples, especially from Europe, where this is already playing out, where we're seeing really transformative changes and we're seeing companies really thrive in this new landscape.
Gosh, you shared so many things that are genuinely exciting, particularly in relation to law and policy, because I had no idea that was starting to come into play. To bring the question back to leadership for a minute, you know, you've just shared all of this incredible information with regards to how this overlay is, you know, coming into our social systems. So for leaders who want to stay ahead of the game, they really need to start embracing circular thinking in terms of the economic opportunity. So what's your advice for leaders to really leverage this space in between these two paradigms and to really be able to thrive in as we move into this new era?
Yeah, I would say, I mean, one can always question what is a leader. You know, I think anyone has the ability to set the tone that creates or magnetizes people to a new outcome, right?
Leaders in life.
Yeah, leaders are not just people who are sanctioned that, you know, they're elected into it or that they're you know, hired for it. You know, we can all lead in one way or another. And that's the concept of agency and the ability for each of us to identify the power and influence that we have in the world around us. So I would say, first and foremost, if you're listening to this and you're like, you have leadership, you know, branded on you, as I would say I do because of the role that I play in the world. But those of you who are listening who are like, not quite there yet, I think you have to consider leadership as really just being about how you live in the world and the likelihood of your choices affecting other people in positive ways. And so for me, the concept of leadership, though, in relation to sustainability and circularity, is there is a huge knowledge gap. So there's this core competency and basic understanding that most leaders do lack today. And that's really a lot of my work going into companies and supporting that transformation. And that's not the fault of anybody. I think the education system has done an appalling job at integrating this, especially with regards to like MBAs. Like, you go to study to literally get a job as a leader and you don't even learn what ESG is, which is environmental social governance, which is the kind of metric of reporting. You don't learn about the circular economy. And if you did, hit me up on social media, because I've worked with so many MBA programs that are just not there yet at integrating this into their learning system. So it does require individual learning. It does require companies to be investing in company skills training so that everybody understands the basics of what this is. So what is the greenhouse gas protocol and what is a scope 3 emission? Because I can guarantee you within the next 3 to 5 years, every company will have to be reporting on their scope 3 emissions, which are their entire supply chain. What is a digital product passport? That is what the European Union is putting into place with regards to nearly every product category, which will require life cycle data. What is life cycle assessment? That is a scientific process of understanding the whole of life environmental impacts of a product, system, or service that can be done both streamlined, you know, like these are the knowledge. And it's, once you learn it, it's actually not that complicated. It's just that we don't live in a world that prioritizes this information yet. And so therefore it's not part of, say, the onboarding of an employee coming into a company. I mean, some pioneering companies absolutely are doing that, like Microsoft, but a lot of certainly SMEs and larger companies in markets that haven't really adapted to this yet, we've got a massive knowledge gap. So the first thing is to find right information, because again, if you go to Google and you just type in this stuff, you're going to get a lot of marketing material. You know, greenwashing is becoming more and more called out, and there's laws around the world that are preventing companies from making claims that they can't back up scientifically, which is the antidote to greenwashing. But at the same time, there is still a lot of people who gain benefit from communicating certain things that are maybe not the most appropriate and correct. So find your sources. I mean, the United Nations definitely has a lot of resources on this. You can start with the Sustainable Development Goals. You can go to the Global Compact. You can look up the Greenhouse Gas Protocol. As I did mention, I have a lot of courses on this stuff, both through the Unschool and through Swivel Skills.
Yeah, but I mean, like I said, I literally did your course yesterday morning. Like, you can put away just a few hours to get a very succinct overview of all of the themes that you're talking about.
Yeah, and I also write, like, I've written on Medium about a lot of this stuff freely, like in my goal. And also, we have a lot of free resources. We have a whole circular redesign toolkit you can download for free and use today. We've had thousands of people use that in their lunchtime sessions with their colleagues just to get a sense of what the circular economy is and how it could apply to their workplace. You know, my goal is to make massive change, and I want to see as many people as possible engage with this. And especially if you're listening and thinking, oh, this is not really, it doesn't really apply to me. Actually, it probably applies to you even more because the kinds of changes that we need are in how we deliver value into the economy. So if you're in sales or marketing, if you're in communications, this is so important because this is about value shifts. It's about changing what we value, because right now we do value convenience and disposability, and that is inherently unsustainable. And so the transformation is about valuing things that last longer, valuing things that are designed better. And that does require all members of society to think differently about how we do get our needs met and what we are willing to spend our hard-earned money on. So, I think at the end of the day, leadership is really about learning. It is about being open to the fact that you will never know everything, but you will certainly be very good at things and that you can always be better at other things. And that's certainly the case with sustainability and circularity, is that it will only strengthen your skill set. And it's certainly a language that you're going to need to have moving into the future.
Mm. So Leila, I want to pick up on one tool, because for those listening, if you walk away with just one tool from this conversation, that's going to make a difference. And one of the things that I thought was brilliant, was a really simple idea, you've already mentioned it, was the life cycle assessment, because mm-hmm. it's something that we can apply in our personal lives and something that we can apply across the board in terms of how we run our business. So I'm wondering if you could explain what the life cycle assessment and life cycle mapping is all about.
Yeah, so life cycle assessment, or LCA, is a scientific process that's governed by an ISO standard, International Standard Organization 14,000 series. So it's been around for about 30 years. And essentially, it is literally a scientific assessment that requires a lot of complex data that then goes through a system of assessing the product across five main life cycle stages: extraction of raw materials, manufacturing, packaging and transportation, use, and end of life. And across these stages, there's multiple points that this product that's been created will intersect with the natural world. And based on, like I said, this kind of complex assessment process, we're looking at all of the different impacts that could occur. Now, LCA is used by companies to either get a snapshot of their current design choices and then change them, or to validate environmentally preferable products and services. According to the ISO standard, any LCA done has to be done in relation to the standard, but also it needs to be peer reviewed before it can be published. So that does make it costly and time consuming. So that's the process of life cycle assessment. It's very useful. It's very important if you are trying to make green claims, and it will feed into new policies that are being developed in the European Union. But then there's the quick and dirty version called life cycle thinking, which is something I've been a proponent of for over 20 years. Mm. It's essentially the same idea that an LCA practitioner would use, but without all the complex data. You're doing essentially a map of what's going on in a product's life. And you basically go through those five main life cycle stages, starting with your materials. So if you take any product, and I do this in workshops with a pen, because it's hilarious how complicated pens are, you basically map all the materials that exist in the product. And then you go back one stage to, like, where did these materials come from in nature? And what natural systems were disrupted in order to get those materials. And then you move forward based on its design, the materials, how they're made, how they're put together, you'll get information about the use and the end of life. And that use phase will determine how long it's used for based on how durable it is. And the end of life will be how likely it is to be recycled, ended up in landfill, or perhaps escaping into nature, which is quite common. And so there's also packaging and transportation, which sits in the middle because it happens across the full life of the product. So in life cycle thinking and life cycle mapping, we're basically spending 20 minutes getting this snapshot. And in this case, Google is your friend, because a lot of this information can be quickly discovered from company websites and a little bit of quick data searching. And that gives us an idea about what's going on. And then we can make comparable decisions between materials, processes, or we can also optimize the design of the product. Mm-hmm. And so in my approach to circular design, we use life cycle thinking as the core process of understanding the current linear model. And then we go about redesigning that with the circular approaches on top of it. And again, that circular redesign toolkit you can get from Unschools or Swivel Skills is free. And that shows you how to go through this whole process. It literally steps you through it. And the thing about this is that when you use life cycle thinking, absolutely 100%, I guarantee you, like, you know, all your money back, your mind will be blown a little bit, because I've literally taught it to like tens of thousands of people. And every time people are like, oh my God, I had no idea this was so complicated. And it really helps you get this perspective on what it takes to make something. It basically exposes the hidden life of the things around us. And even companies who literally design these products, they do it and they're like, we had no idea. Mm. So it's a really powerful tool. And then if you want, the next stage from like doing a life cycle map would be looking at LCAs that are published in the field that you're working in, the product category. And that's if you go to Google Scholar, which is a special part of Google that houses only peer-reviewed academic published data. You can look for LCAs on particular materials or products. And it's likely there will be there, because it's a very robust scientific field that's been around for a long time. And you can then kind of get a snapshot of what the data is saying from other studies. And you can use that to inform your decisions.
Now, chances are if you are doing a life cycle map, one of the things you're going to uncover is the amount of waste that is left over. And, you know, arguably waste is the biggest challenge that we face with, you know, the elimination of 2 billion tons of waste that we produce every single year. Much of, as you've already said, much of which comes from...
Is that just in Australia or globally? 2 billion?
That was globally, I believe. This is from my homework yesterday. Maybe I've jotted my notes down incorrectly.
I think it's a lot more. I mean, we produce a significant amount of waste, and only 20% of all waste ever produced is recycled, and only 9% of plastics is recycled. So, like, we are very much in a waste fueled economy. So I don't know. I'd be interested to know what that is.
Look, I might have incorrectly jotted down my stats in my fact finding yesterday. So I would trust your stats more than mine on this particular subject. But it's a lot of waste, you know. And as you've said, much of it comes from disposable products such as like toilet paper or chopsticks or coffee cups. So I'm really curious to know why you believe that the waste problem is, in solving it, is the holy grail of sustainability.
Okay, well, first of all, waste is just a misplaced resource.
Yeah.
Right? It's that we have devalued something, because in nature there is literally no such thing as waste. When something dies, its constituent parts become the fuel to create something new. So in nature there's actually no such thing as death, which is a really kind of metaphysical thing to think about. But ultimately everything is cycled around and around, and it is essentially a life-giving resource. There is no elements of the system that are not somehow fitting into a beautiful kind of complex puzzle that supports the system sustaining itself. Whereas humans have created waste, which is just shit we bury in holes in the ground or burn. It's crazy. And it's like, if you've ever hung out at a landfill site, which I'm almost certain you haven't, you would be like, oh my gosh, what the fuck are we doing?
Yeah.
It's so crazy. And the way we deal with waste is so dumb as well. Like, literally, they like compact it into squares and then they stack it up in holes in the ground, often old mine sites. And then every day they have to put soil on top of it to repress like the odors and birds and skulls. And if you think about it, like, this is like nappies and apple cores and like batteries and all this shit. And it's just leaching toxic crap. Ugh. And then you've got methane emissions, which are 85 times more potent than greenhouse gas. Like, it's just so dumb. And then at the end of the landfill's life, they'll cap it and they'll make a greenfield site. And yeah, I don't know. Like, we just, it's so archaic the way we deal with it. And in Northern Europe, they actually don't really do landfills anymore. They do incineration, which has its own complex problems, because obviously you're getting energy, but then, you know, you're losing those materials forever. At least, like, some really kind of weird concept of landfill is we can go back and mine landfill and get out the valuable materials that, you know, from the past. And there's like thousands of landfill sites that were built in, say, like the 1940s in sand dunes, like where they just would like at resort coastal towns, they just like dig a hole in the sand and dump all their stuff and then cover it up. And then what do you think happens to sand? In a road. So now we have all these historic, like, crappy landfills, like, just washing trash out into the ocean. Like, yeah. I'm laughing because it's just so ridiculous, right? So we basically have this, just, it's when you really look at it, you think, God, what a dumb idea. Like, this, we really could do better. We really could. Like, we can go to space, which actually space junk is a whole other issue. There's literally millions of pieces of junk orbiting Earth from all the space missions. That's a whole other conversation. Anywho, so the point is that we have just basically made a system of like when you were a kid and you were asked to clean your room and you just shoved everything under the bed, which was my classic tactic. That is like what humanity's done. We're like, put it in a bin, put it on the street, forget about it. Magically, it'll disappear. And recycling is no better, because recycling, unfortunately, validates the production of waste. So whilst recycling is part of the circular economy, it is a very low-level solution. We actually don't want to rely on recycling, because recycling is a system that reinforces the fact that disposability is part of the system. And as I already stated, we're not anywhere near the rate of recapture and recycling that would make it a valuable solution to the problems that we face. So we will have it always, but it's definitely not the thing that we should be focusing on at all. And so basically, in my mind, waste is essentially a lost resource that we need to figure out how to utilize better. I think we can definitely learn from nature here, where everything can be broken down and reconfigured in different ways. But also we have the option to design products and services that last longer, that are reusable, as was already mentioned. And so, yeah, I mean, I have this dream of a post-disposable future. Like, what does it look like where we don't literally have trash cans in our lives anymore? And to be fair, 70 to 100 years ago, that was how it was. Like, yes, you had like rubble from building and you had soles from shoes and things like that. But nearly every material that was used before the plastics revolution was naturally digestible by nature in some way. I mean, glass takes a really long time. But in the sense that we've created these incompatible systems now, and our technology is a massive issue as well. You know, just to put it in perspective, we've entered into, according to geologists, this period called the Anthropocene. Anthro meaning human. So yeah. The age of
I interviewed Gaia Vince, actually, who wrote a book on this exact subject. Yeah.
Right. And so the crazy thing about this is the way the geologists are determining when we entered into the Anthropocene, which the kind of common consensus, which is not confirmed yet, is around 1950, is by doing these soil samples of like taking core samples of like ice and soil and rock and trees. And there's this like layer that is evident all over the world, which is this layer of soot, aluminium, persistent chemicals, nuclear isotopes. And these are all things that have been man-made that are not absorbed back into nature in the like, of course, they would eventually over a very long period of time. But they kind of show this really significant shift, which was around 1950. And so, you know, we're living in an era of human dominance on the planet to our own detriment. And for me, that shows a huge opportunity. If we designed ourselves into this mess, then we can definitely design ourselves out. And that's the challenge in front of us. And waste is an opportunity to create, I'm not going to say better, but create products and services and things that meet our needs, but in much more elegant ways. And right now it's so clumsy what we do. And you know, it's also shitty because companies design products that are wasteful, whether it be the physical product itself or whether it be the packaging, and you and I pay for that bad decision because we all pay for rates when we live in a house that the council, a large percentage of those rate money is picking up your trash and finding places for it. So we pay for bad design and we don't realize it. And we also pay for it in, you know, the bigger sense of like the environmental and social impacts that those waste systems have. So, you know, it's inherently inequitable in my opinion. And the circular economy and dealing with waste is actually not just an environmental, but it's an equity issue, because when we have products that are designed to break, which most products are, you have people who are locked into continual consumption cycles and they're forced to continue buying products because they can only afford to buy the cheap product that's intentionally engineered to break after a period of time, so that they're forced to buy new products over and over again. And if you're already suffering financially, that's forcing you into this kind of like system of inequity. And and whereas people who are wealthier can afford to perhaps pay a significant amount up front for a product that's going to last longer. You know, so there's so many equity issues that can be resolved. Waste is also something that is trafficked and it is processed in very substandard ways in communities where there are lax environmental laws and there are communities who are desperate for income. So you have Thailand fishing communities that are getting e-waste dumped and they are processing in these extremely unsafe ways for their own health and the environment, not because they're bad people, but because the system allows and encourages that. So, you know, the issue with waste is that somebody has to be, somebody has to stay in poverty in order for waste to exist. It's a really inequitable system. And those of us in Western countries have a lot to answer for in our consumption choices and also in the design of the products that are ultimately fueling the consumerism in the Western world.
Layla, you mentioned technology before, and we, you know, we're clearly in an age of exponential progress, which undeniably has risks associated with it and also implications in relation to the environment and what we're talking about today. But there are also huge opportunities here in terms of empowering sustainability. So I'm really curious to understand what, in your view, we should be concerned about, but also what opportunities are available to us in reflection of like AI and automation and other technologies that can support us in this journey.
Okay, Knew there was going to be an AI question.
Here we are. We've landed.
AI. Oh, I don't know. I have such mixed feelings about it. I recently did like the ChatGPT Scarlett Johansson version where I asked her to be me, and it was really creepy because she was kind of good, but then really bad.
So, you're like,
I was like, I can do much better than this, Scarlett. Thank you very much. But I'm like, she's just going to get better. The better I get, the better she's going to get. It's super weird. But I do definitely think that AI offers an amazing opportunity as far as efficiency goes. We can optimize a lot of our systems that are currently wasteful. However, at the same time, everything we do digitally has a physical footprint on the planet because of the servers and the energy and the carbon emissions, right? So, you know, even this video call and you re-watching or re-listening to it, all of those actions on the internet have physical impacts. And so we know that the rise in information technology sector and the Internet of Things is going to just put even more pressure on a climate ravaged world unless we change the way we code. So like green coding is a huge thing where we're designing lighter weight code. And there's a really amazing example between Bitcoin and Ethereum where like the carbon emissions associated with mining these coins is huge. Whereas about a year and a half ago, Ethereum changed the process of mining and they reduced its carbon emissions by 97%.
Which is huge.
It's insane, huge. Right? Like, yeah. And that's because of the way in which the structure or the system was designed and the system around it. And, you know, any website or any digital interface can be designed differently. You know, I mean, there's a whole bunch of different things in this space. Mm. Like I even will admit my websites are terrible. They've got like huge carbon loads because the service providers that we use, they don't buy green energy or green servers, right?
So you kind it's of an have important this- conversation though, because I think a lot of us think, oh, well, you know, I'm going to start a digital business because it's more sustainable without actually understanding the full spectrum of the carbon impact.
Everything we do has an impact.
Yeah.
Everything. Nothing is devoid of impact. It's a combination, we call it trade-offs. Like what is the outcome of the action and is the outcome more beneficial than the loss from the system? So like packaging, for example, packaging that protects the product and if to a certain degree and reduces waste is actually in many cases like a kind of necessary evil because we are able to protect the product if the product, is of high value. So you kind of have this like trade-off that you have to make. I mean, we live in an imperfect system and in the process of the transformation, there's going to be a lot of these trade-off decisions that have to be made as we kind of tighten up the solutions. So yeah, we have, certainly there's like more greener servers and there's like servers in Sweden that the heat generated from them is used to heat houses and stuff. So there's all these kind of co-design processes that are happening or it's called industrial symbiosis where you've got different companies using waste resources to support the inputs of others. But so I think though, aside from all of that, that the impact of technology and the fact that most tech that's physical tech, whether it be the computer that we're speaking on or, you know, any of the new fandangle, you know, tech talk to devices that fill our lives, they all require very complex minerals and metals, many of them conflict minerals and metals that are extracted from lands that you will probably never go to and you will probably never witness the tragedy of the conditions of which the people who are extracting those minerals and metals go through. So, you know, there is a lot of equity issues in the supply chain around our technology as well. And then not to mention the fact that most technology is designed to not be repaired, but there's a massive repair movement and France actually has new repair laws that are really transforming the industry. So I think we'll see repair become one of the major factors in the next few years. So aside from all of that, I think technology offers a huge opportunity. One of the big things of the circular economy is that we have to manage assets. So I actually do think a lot of the kinds of solutions that get put into play will involve some sort of digital interface because it's about knowing where things are so that whoever owns them are able to track them and keep them. And if you are then buying into a service of having things delivered in reusable packaging, for example, that's all going to need a tech interface. And so I actually think there's a huge opportunity in what I call circular service design. Service design is the type of design that understands the experience that a customer has in engaging with a business. And there's a lot of opportunity to redesign that service so that it is circular and really frictionless, we call in design, where you don't actually notice it, because most design done well, you won't notice. It's only poor design that you'll notice and you'll be frustrated by it. So there's a big opportunity and I am excited by it, as well as a little petrified. And I think a lot of people make decisions that have unintended consequences about their digital choices, and that, you know, there's an opportunity for us to really improve the efficiency and impact of those decisions.
Mm. So I've come to my last question today. What I'm curious to know is if there is anything that you feel is super important that you haven't already shared that would be valuable for our audience to hear.
I mean, I feel we covered a lot of ground.
We covered a lot of ground. It was a sprint.
Yeah, I will say, like, generally, so in my experience, I work with lots of different people, and I think that there is a little bit of an agency crisis. And what I don't mean like design agency. I mean, like, agency is the concept in sociology and psychology of like how you see the role that you can play in the world and your ability to advocate for yourself or your ideas. But also just in sense of like a lot of the kind of cycles of consumption and waste are kind of built into the psychology of status and perhaps self-esteem. And, you know, there's a lot of things at play when it comes to why we buy stuff and why we also perhaps don't value the things that are in our lives. And so I would challenge everyone listening to think about, you know, where they can, you know, challenge their own understanding of their choices and why and how they might not be engaging with this. Or if you're really passionate about it and you're already engaging with it, don't beat yourself up, because that's the other thing. Like, there's just so much shame and guilt that exists in this space. This is a process of transformation, which requires testing and experimenting. And sometimes we're going to make decisions that are not going to end up being great. And sometimes we have to accept that our choices will have impacts and that we will then mitigate those impacts in other areas of our lives or decisions. And it's those nuances that are really important. So agency is really about understanding that each of us has the power and influence to affect the world around us, and the choices that we make have impacts, and we need to be more informed about those choices and also be a bit open to the outcome not always being what we expect, but to learn from it. And I think that's a lesson in life as much as it is in helping to change the world for the better.
As you mentioned, we have covered a lot today, but as I said, having had a really good look at the work you have available online, the content, the tools, the templates. You have offered and built a platform that really will support people to go on this journey. Where can we learn more about your work or get access to the resources that you have available?
Yeah, so unschools.co, you can take up to 100 courses, short courses. You can download lots of free resources. And then we also have Swivel Skills, which is the at-scale corporate sustainability training platform. You can take individual classes. We have a whole course in circular economy leadership, for example. But the idea with that is that companies pay for people to go through the program and then they actually can apply it in their workplace. And then we also have my own website, leilarajarali.com, where you can read all my Medium articles, where I write extensively about systems thinking, life cycle thinking, many of the topics we talked about. And follow me on LinkedIn. I have 3 LinkedIn learning courses that if you're a subscriber to LinkedIn, you can watch for free, or I very readily, and that's probably what you saw yesterday, post them and you can watch them for free for 24 hours if you post them. So if you follow me on LinkedIn, then you'll get access to that and any of the other things I write about. So
yeah, I linked through from your website, actually.
Oh, really? And you could watch.
I did the whole course. Including the quizzes.
I'm all for it. I'm not the owner of LinkedIn. So,
yeah.
But I do love LinkedIn, actually. I've really enjoyed working with the platform. And actually, the LinkedIn learning courses I found to be extremely fun. If you do watch them, you will see I'm a little obsessed with props, especially my first one, which is Sustainability as an Innovation Opportunity, which we filmed during COVID. And I have to say, like, I really pulled out all the stops with the random props that we just found.
I'll have to check that one out. Yeah, but like I said before, you really simplify complexity and really break down a vast amount of information into tangible action steps. And I think that is one of your gifts in the world. Thank is you. The ability to really act as a translator for the planet and to show us the way into this new paradigm. So I am not only grateful to have you on the podcast today, I am grateful that we have you leading us, showing us at this exact point in human history.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
thank you so much for joining me on the DNA of Purpose podcast, Dr. Leila Ajaralu.
Thank you, as always, for dedicating your time to the DNA of Purpose podcast. As we conclude today's episode, I invite you to extend the conversation online. Feel free to reach out via LinkedIn or follow along at Rebecca Maplad, that is M-A-K-L-A-D, on Instagram, where we're crafting a tapestry of stories, reflections, tools, and insights to empower your purpose-driven leadership strategy. I love feedback, and we always welcome guest suggestions. Should today's episode ignite a spark within you, reviews really do help us to continue to attract the world's most prominent purpose-driven leaders as our guests. And if you know somebody who would benefit from one of our episodes, then share that story with abundance. A big thanks to Supernova Tribe, who produce this podcast with style, and Guide Your Light, a network for podcasts with purpose.